Tonight we look at the last lesson in this series on Gideon from the book of Judges, and tonight we're going to cover chapter 8. I hope you've enjoyed this study. Personally, I have dug a little bit deeper into the background to this man that I did not know a whole lot about, and particularly this chapter, chapter 8. And I hope to be able to bring some things out in chapter 8 that sometimes, as we say from the English translation, out of the Hebrew text or the Masoretic text, doesn't actually give you the picture. One of the things that you can do, though, without learning Hebrew, is different translations. Like the King James and the New King James would be likely of one school of thought. And then if you had the American Standard Version, or you had the ESV, English Standard Version, or any number of other translations, you're going to find some variants. You're going to find some differences. And wherever you find the differences, that may raise the question, well, why did this one translate it this way, and then this one translated something totally different? And I'll try to, there's one particular here in verse 13 that I'll try to bring out to show you how that difference can arise. And that not just true in this chapter of Judges, chapter 8, can be in a lot of places in the Old and the New Testament, particularly the Old Testament. But I call this chapter the triumph of Gideon and his troubles. You would think that a man that took 300 soldiers and went up against 135,000 Midianite army in the battle at the foot of the hill of Moreh in the Jezreel Valley, you would think a man 301 against that many would be respected. In the first three verses of the eighth chapter, there is a problem with the tribe of Manasseh's brother, Ephraim. And we'll talk about that particular trouble. And then verse 4, down through a section, down to about verse 9, when Gideon takes these 300 men, and they are now pursuing the last of the two Midianite kings that were in the battle, Zeba and Zalmunna. Oreb and Zeb, those are the two guys that were already beheaded in chapter 7 that the Ephraimites actually killed. They conquered them, killed them as they were escaping from the battle at the hill of Moreh. But these two guys are still left to be captured, and their army. It is chapter 8 in the book of Judges that we are told that 120,000 men who drew the sword were killed in the battle. And there's 15,000 left. 15,000 with Zeba and Zalmunna. By the way, Zeba, the Hebrew word Zeba, means to slaughter. So evidently he got his name as a reputation. And Zalmunna carries with the idea of to withdraw, to be withdrawn from for destruction. And there is a situation here where Gideon challenges them once he captures them, and he asks them, what kind of men were they that you slew or killed at Mount Tabor? Mount Tabor. Now, Mount Tabor is a very significant mountain in the Jezreel Valley. It's just due east of the hill where Nazareth, the city of Nazareth, sits. And, of course, we'll get into the details of what they said to Gideon in view of that. Because the reason Gideon is pursuing these two men, Zeba and Zalmunna, and the Midianite army, the remnant of the Midianite army, is because of something long time ago that happened at Mount Tabor. By the way, that would be Jabin, who would be the king of the Canaanites, who had a captain whose name was Sisera, if you remember the account. And that is where the woman, Jael, drove the tent spike through Sisera's head. She was a Kenite, the nomadic tribe that was sort of banding together with the Canaanite king there, Jabin. But the battle of Barak and Deborah was at Mount Tabor. Okay, that's in the early part of the book of Judges. So the war of Mount Tabor, where certain Israelites were put to death, now has a history in the days of Gideon. So that you put the puzzle pieces together. But let's look now. First of all, let me back up one. If I can do this. Yeah. It's sensitive on this pursuit. Let's look at the first section here. Gideon is now pursuing. He has left the Jezreel Valley. He's heading down the Jordan River Valley, and he's about to cross, he's going to cross the Jordan River, and he's going to go up on what's called the Jordanian Plateau. If I were to have a dry erase board here, I would draw that the Jordan River Valley is a deep gorge. If you came out of the Jezreel Valley, you'd be going downhill, literally downhill. And then when you cross the river, you would be going straight up. If you went to the Jordan, cross the Jordan over into the land of the Transjordanian Plateau, it would be like climbing a bluff. Okay, so the Jordan River Valley out of the Sea of Galilee going into the Dead Sea is downhill. Sea of Galilee up here, Dead Sea way down here, and the Jordan River runs downhill into the Dead Sea. By the way, the Dead Sea in Israel is the lowest point, not just in Israel, on the planet, on the entire earth. It is the lowest point below sea level than anywhere in the world. So you're talking about from Mount Hermon, 9,000, almost 10,000 foot high, with snow on the top of it, and the melting snows in the summertime, the river comes down out of Mount Hermon, feeds into the Sea of Galilee, runs through the Sea of Galilee, becomes the Jordan River, downhill, snakes all the way down, empties into the Dead Sea, and everything evaporates out of there because it's desert down there. Okay? Gideon with these 300 men, by the way, how many did he lose in the battle at the Hill of Moreh? They lost 120,000 in the skirmish. How many of his 300 men did he lose? Zero. Not a one. According to military strategies, what would you guess you might lose of 301 versus 135,000 plus four major leaders? Oreb, Zeb, Zema, Zalmunna. You'd think, well, you're going to lose a handful, right? You might lose half. You might lose down to 50, whatever. Zero. That's why this became known as one of the most famous battles of all Israelite history. Literally more famous than almost David killing Goliath. It's mentioned in Isaiah chapter 10. It's mentioned in Psalms 83. It's referenced into the song service. It's referenced into the prophet's history. Every Israelite knew the battle of Gideon and the defeat of these great Midianites. Okay? But in these first three verses, after the Ephraimites stop and kill Oreb and Zeb, they got a little confrontation with Gideon. He's a Manasseh. He's a tribe of Manasseh, which, by the way, Manasseh, Ephraim, those are the sons of Joseph. So they're from the direct bloodline of Joseph. And the point is, when the battle struck, or you went into battle, why didn't you call us? Why didn't you call us? Why did you wait till after the battle was over now to call us to do mop-up duty? Okay, so here's rivalry. Surely there's not a brother or a sister or two brothers or two sisters anywhere in this audience that's ever had a rivalry. Never had any competition one with the other. Listen. If you want real prestige as a military person, and here's the greatest battle so far in the history of Israel, and you didn't let us participate, that's what they're saying. You know, they wanted some prestige here. They wanted some clout with this. Oh yeah, you're the one everybody's going to talk about. You're the one everybody's going to sing about. You're the one everybody's going to make a monument to, great Gideon, warrior of Israel. Why didn't you call us? We could have helped you out, by the way. Gideon started out with 32,000, did he not? He asked anybody afraid, go home. 22,000 went home. He ended up with 10,000. God said, you got too many. Take them down to what's called the Spring of Harod. Showed you a picture of that in the lesson of that. Actually, there's a Google map picture of a man actually down on his knees, drinking like those would have drank, by which you distinguish. Not these, keep these 300. And that's how it ended up. So God wasn't going to use a big army anyway to fight the Midianites at the Hill of Moreh in the Jezreel Valley. Notice Gideon's statement in verse 2. He said unto them, what have I done now in comparison of you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? Ephraim is a territory. Abiezer is a little city, little town. Okay? Is not the football program of the state of Alabama, using a sports illustration, greater than the little school over here at East Limestone, or whatever school we could mention. In other words, you're a great tribe, you're a great nation, you do great things anyway. Why are you comparing how insignificant you are to this little town that I live in? You know, I'm a small town guy. You big mountain people live up in the top of the mountains. Notice then it says in verse 3, God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, the rulers of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. What was I able to do in comparison to you? In other words, you've defeated the real head men of the whole army anyway. Why are you complaining to me? In other words, you've got some kind of recognition. You're the ones that killed the two guys. You're the ones that delivered them to me. The Bible then says in verse 3, then their anger was abated or subsided toward him when he said that. In other words, he diffused a very highly emotional problem. But listen very carefully. If you were to continue to study a history of the Bible, beginning right here, here's what you're going to find. The tribe of Ephraim, historically, their track record was to be completely filled with pride. And they're going to do that not just with Manasseh. They're going to do that with Judah. And ultimately, they're going to do that all the way down the stream of time until God sends the Assyrian nation in and gets rid of it. Ephraim is sort of like, you had a party and you didn't call us. You knew you were going to win and you didn't let us participate. And he says, I let you participate. You killed these two guys that were the leaders of this. And I'm going to do mop-up work out here of two other guys that are not even significant to the two guys that you killed. It would be like this. Al-Qaeda. You familiar with Al-Qaeda? The terrorist group? Okay. How about the military force that actually captured Osama bin Laden and killed him? Do you reckon those guys go down in history, in U.S. military history? Do you reckon people will talk about, these are the guys that captured and killed Osama bin Laden? Is that prestige? That's prestige, isn't it? Okay, folks, that's Oreb and Zeb. Osama bin Laden, the head of Al-Qaeda. Oreb and Zeb, the princes, the leaders, the military stronghold, the brains of the whole Midianite army. You got them. Who am I going after? I'm going after just small operatives out here. I'm doing the mop-up work. That would be like whoever is second, third, fourth command in Al-Qaeda. We're getting to say, I'm just going out here to get the rest of them. You got the head guys. What are you complaining about? That's exactly what they're arguing right here. That's how Gideon stop them from complaining. Okay? But then you come to verses 4 to 9. And let me move on to the map here. I don't have a pointer, but I'm going to give you sort of an idea. Down at the bottom left corner of this map is the Valley of Jezreel. By the way, this is Google Earth. This is present-day Israel on a map. That's why you got all those numbers. Those are road highway markers for the regular roads in Israel, northern Israel. You're actually on this map. North is east. The top of the map is east. North is to the left of this map. It's like I tilted it 90 degrees, okay? West is down at the bottom, and south is to the right, okay? Those red arrows there are what I believe, according to my studying of the Bible, the actual route that Gideon took out of the Jezreel Valley from the base of the hill of Moreh, across the Jordan River, up into now the Jordan Plateau to go capture Zeba and Zalmunna. Okay? So what he did is, he came down out of the Jezreel Valley, that's the first arrow on the far left, went up to a little town called Beth-Shean. Beth-Shean, by the way, still there. It's an ancient city. Beth-Shean is where the Philistines that killed Saul, Jonathan, and Saul's sons on Mount Gilboa, that's where they hung their bodies on the wall. You remember in your Bible, in the book of 1 Samuel, Bethshean, that city right there in Israel, even today. That's when the men of Jabesh Gilead came from the Jordanian plateau, way back there in the hill, when they found out that Saul had been hung, his body had been hung, and they came and rescued the bodies of Saul and Jonathan and the other boys. Took them off the wall and took them and cremated them, burned them. Okay, and then David learns about it and blesses the city of Jabesh Gilead for showing kindness to Saul and to his family. But they went down the Jordan River Valley here. I'm trying not to look that way because the PA, if you talk into the PA, you can hear. So they went, as it were, to the right down the Jordan River Valley. Now, in looking at Bible geography, if you looked at a map in your Bible that doesn't have what I call physical characteristics, mountains and valleys and rivers and canyons and so forth, if you just looked at a map in your Bible and it was a two-dimensional map that had just pictures like dots and colors and so forth, you wouldn't get the picture of what you're seeing here in this picture of Google Earth. Because what I did with this map is I tilted it sideways. Like if you go to Google Maps and go to Google Earth and there's a feature called 3D, okay, and you touch the button of 3D and then you take your fingers and you push it, tilt it sideways, it'll show you the mountains and it'll show you canyons, okay. To the far right here, where that right arrow is the River Jabbok. River Jabbok, very, very important river in history. Okay, it's not in the land of Israel on the side of what you would normally call the Promised Land, okay. That is the hill country of Gilead. That is the tribe of Gad. Reuben, Gad, half-tribe of Manasseh. Okay? The way you would travel, if you were going to go up into the Transjordanian Plateau, is you wouldn't just cross the Jordan River and go straight up a bluff to get to the top of the mountain. What you would do is you would find an easy way to go in slight slope elevation to go up the hills. And let me illustrate this way. There is a mountain, or we call it a mountain, in Huntsville called Monte Santo. Anybody in here doesn't know where Monte Santo Mountain is in Huntsville? City of Huntsville sits on the western side, Monte Santo Mountain's to the side. You know there's a Highway 431. Okay, it goes over the mountain, goes into Gunnersville. If you look very, very carefully, 431 goes through a gap. It doesn't go straight up Monte Santo Mountain and straight over the other side. It goes sideways in through a gap in Monte Santo Mountain. Monte Santo Mountain's on this side, Green Mountain. You're familiar with Green Mountain in Huntsville? Green Mountain's to your right, Monte Santo would be your left as you're looking east. And so the highway, the civil engineers, went through the gap to make Highway 431. That's exactly what that is. The Jabbok River was the dividing point from Sihon, whose capital was in Heshbon, and Og. You remember those two kings that the children of Israel defeated on the eastern side of the Jordan River, okay, in the book of Joshua, before they ever crossed the Jordan River. Okay? So, what Gideon did is he went up that gorge, the Jabbok Gorge. There's a river in Arizona, actually it starts, I think, in southern Utah, called the Colorado River. If you remember the Colorado River. Okay, the Colorado River runs through a canyon. You familiar with what that canyon is called? The Grand Canyon. Is that not right? Okay, so here's a river that's carved out a route. By the way, water takes the course of least resistance. It makes the Grand Canyon actual. Well, that's what the Jabbok River did. The Jabbok River starts up in the top of the Jordanian Mountains, okay, and runs downhill into the Jordan River. And then it goes to the Dead Sea. So the overflow, the watershed, comes down through this gorge, through this gap. Okay. On the left-hand side of the Jabbok River, up on this ridge, are two little towns. One is called Succoth. S-U-C-C-O-T-H. That's in your chapter. Just a little bit further down there is a town called Penuel. Penuel. Succoth is where Jacob Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That is where Jacob, when coming from the land where his wives are from, Aram, you remember Rachel and Leah and all their kids, that's where Jacob came when he met Esau. Okay, and of course Esau, they befriend, and then Esau goes back to the Edomite territory. And the Bible says that Jacob built a house and a sheepfold for his sheep. I would say Jacob built a ranch for his sheep. He's got him a ranch house, and he's got him a place to put his sheep and a fence. Okay, now let me sort of fast forward in some information here that will help you appreciate Succoth. If you were going to go into the cattle business, you're not in the cattle business, but you're going to go in the cattle business, several things you're going to need. By the way, I'm not in the cattle business, so I wouldn't know everything, but I do know at least about this much looking at my neighbors. Okay? You're going to need a piece of land to put them on, right? You're going to need the equipment by which to take care of them. And if you want to keep them on your piece of land, what have you got to have? Keep them out of your neighbor's land. What do you got to have? You got to have fencing. Isn't that right? Okay, what kind of fencing would we use today? Well, you can use plank fencing. You know, up at Cade's Cove, they use split rails, right? Just take old wood and split it and then stack it, you know, X, Y, Z, like Civil War battlefield style. But in this country, what I've seen is you take a metal T-post, you drive it in the ground, and you drive, then you run wire, right? It can be electric wire, or it can be what? Barbed wire. Barbed wire. All right. How in the world do you think Jacob, on a Transjordanian plateau, would build fencing to keep his sheep inside of a local area without them just roaming all over like they do in Ghana? Which, by the way, they roam everywhere in Ghana. They don't keep them fenced in, and at least I didn't see it. What would you make fencing out of? Well, you just go manufacture the wire and put barbs in it and so forth. No, here's what they did. They took thorns and briars and interwove them and made fencing. That's how you made fence. That's how you made a sheepfold. Well, thorns is different from briars, as you'll see here in the text in just a second. There are certain shrubs that even we have in this country that have long thorns on them. Have you ever heard of a fire thorn shrub? Okay. And a lot of other shrubs that are out there. And everybody knows what a blackberry vine looks like, right? Blackberry vine, wild blackberry vine, has what? We'd call that the briars, you know. If you go pick blackberries, you're going to have to get in the briars. Okay? Thorns, briars. Thorns would be a stiff, heavy, shrubby tree. You could cut that like a post. And then you would interweave the briars, the blackberry vines, you make you a fence. Now get this picture in your head. Does that look like barbed wire fence to you? Could you take briars? And could you take a thorn bush, set it up, weave it together? Could you make an enclosure that looked like a barbed wire fence? Isn't that ingenious? By the way, some of you probably say, I believe I'm going to make me a little pen for my dog. What am I going to make it out of? I got all kind of blackberry vines out here. I'm going to cut these blackberry vines, and I'm going to weave them together, and I'm going to make me a fence. By the way, now you know how Jacob made fencing. And that's what you put your sheep in. He said, no, a sheep will run right through a briar fence. Go ahead and try it. See how that operates. I was riding a horse one time down in Decatur, Alabama, and the horse decided that it wanted to get away from me, as it were, and to get to the pack that I was sort of pulling behind, and that horse ran me through a briar field. Trust me, the horse didn't like it. I definitely didn't like it. Briars and thorns have a way of keeping you hemmed in, right? That's the composite material Jacob made his sheepfolds out of. By the way, if you're a nomad and you travel from place to place, briars is your organic fence post. By the way, it's biodegradable. It'll rot. Or somebody else could use the materials out of it. Guess what Gideon's going to use with it in a minute? Remember that. Briars and thorns. Okay, Peniel. Peniel is the town where Jacob saw an angel. Remember, wrestled with an angel. His hip was pulled out of joint. And he named the place after the angel departed, Penuel. It means face of God. I have seen the face of God and lived. So these are ancient cities. These are Jacob cities on the eastern side of the Jordan River. When Gideon gets to Succoth, he tells the men, or he sends men to Succoth and said, "We are weary from chasing this army. We're about to find them and defeat ultimately the Midianite army. But we are exhausted, but we're going to keep on until we get the job done. We need some bread. We need provisions. My army is weak." What is the statement of the men of Succoth? Verse 5. It says, it says in verse 6, "And the princes of Succoth said, Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand, and that we should give bread unto thy army?" Later on in the text, verse 15, when Gideon shows back up at this town, he says, "Behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, with whom you did upbraid me, saying." Now, upbraid means to criticize. So when you read verse 6, you don't read verse 6 with a mild, calm, gentle tone of voice. You read it like you're being sarcastic. You got these guys in your hands? You haven't got these guys in your hands. What makes us think you're going to get these guys in your hands? You think we're going to give you bread? You don't have them yet. And that's pretty much the way they approached answering Gideon. By the way, let me give you some background to these two towns. These two towns that are up here on this ridge line of that far right arrow, on the Jordan River side, on the Jordan countryside, the Midianites were nomadic people. They lived up there close to Penuel and Succoth. They lived up in that region. So if Zeba and Zalmunna win the battle, now get this, if they win this battle against Gideon, but they gave bread to Gideon and to his army to help defeat Zeba and Zalmunna, what is going to be the retaliation of the Midianites on these two towns? You get it, right? They're terrified of these two men, Zeba and Zalmunna, that Gideon is after. Hey, they live around here where our towns are. We don't see them in your hands. It doesn't look like you've got them in your hands. Oh, we know you're pursuing them. We're not going to give you any bread. That's in essence what they said. Gideon was angry. And he tells them a little thing. Notice. It says, well, we'll get to that in a minute. Well, it says it in verse 7. Gideon said, "Therefore, when the Lord has delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into mine hand, then I will," watch this line, "tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." Where did I talk about thorns and briars before? That's where Jacob built his sheepfold. So briars and thorns were well known around this place. By the way, if you got fencing anywhere in North Alabama and you don't have goats to eat everything around your fence, you pray tell me what's growing in your fence row. Blackberry vines, right? At least they are at my house. Okay? By the way, I don't want them down because I want the blackberries. Don't want the thorns, but you can't have one without the other. I'm going to tear your flesh with briars and thorns. Now, how many of y'all ever had a whipping by your daddy? Or even your mama, for that matter? Can you imagine somebody taking a big bundle of blackberry vines and walking up to you and said, "I'm going to teach you a lesson. I'm going to teach you a lesson you're never going to forget." That's one school of thought. When I was really doing some digging in here, in the Hebrew language, the word tear in this passage means to thresh, like a threshing instrument. Now let me explain what a threshing instrument is in Israel. A winnowing fork was a long piece of wood handle with a pitchfork end made out of wood, and you would scoop like you would a shovel and toss the grain up in the air, and the wind would blow the chaff away and the grain would fall to the ground. That's called winnowing the grain. Toss it up, wind blow the chaff away. Scoop it, toss it up, wind blow the chaff away. Until ultimately, you don't see any more chaff going. It's nothing but grain. And that's when you scooped it up and you put it in a basket and you carry it home with you. That's not threshing. Threshing was an instrument that was a sled, like a wooden sled, like Santa Claus's sled. And you hooked ropes to the front of the sled and you hooked them to a cow. Okay? And you went around in a threshing floor in a circle. It would go around in a circle. And the winnowing sled, or excuse me, the threshing sled, a man rode on it. He either stood on it or put a chair on it so that he could guide it. The bottom of that sled had sharp rocks in it. Sharp, sharp rocks in it. So what you would do is you'd take all of what you'd harvested, throw it in the threshing floor, put your cow, hook it up to the threshing sled, and you'd ride that around in a circle until you crushed all the grain was in there. Crushed all the vines and all the things associated with the grain. After you crushed all that together, then you got the fork and you tossed the grain up in the air and let the wind blow the chaff away. You threshed it first and then you winnowed the grain. Give you some Bible background knowledge. By the way, even Jesus mentions things like this in his teaching. Very common illustration in their day. Now here's another school of thought. And various commentaries believe this is what happened. That when Gideon got back, what he meant by what he said was, I'm going to lay all you men down on the ground out here in this threshing floor. I'm going to put briars on top of you. And I'm going to run the threshing machine over the top of you in front of every citizen in your town. By the way, I'd take a whipping with the briars, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? If the second scenario is the case, and by the way, there is some pretty strong evidence for that being the case. By the time Gideon got through with them, they were dead. They were dead. When you get to Penuel, they're not going to do anything for Gideon either. He says, I'm going to tear down your tower. By the way, your military tower, your watchtower. We'll tear your tower down. I'm going to kill every man in this city. That's exactly what the text said he did. So anyway, cross then the Jordan, go up the Jabbok River, up the mountainside, and they find the Midianites in verse 10, Zeba and Zalmunna, were in Karkor. Karkor. Now, Karkor is somewhere back to the far top of the right-hand corner of this map. I didn't get all of it, but Amman, Jordan is today the capital of Jordan. Somewhere between Amman and where that last era is, was a depression in the ground. Karkor is the Hebrew word for a deep ground. Literally, it means deep ground. It means like a hollowed out place. Okay, so that when you got down in the bowl of this geographical territory, you could hide down in there. How many of you are familiar with Cades Cove in the Smoky Mountains? Cades Cove. Okay. You remember you can drive along like Knoxville, then you get to Sevierville and you see the mountains in the distance? Okay. But if you didn't know Cades Cove was back over on the other side of those mountains, you wouldn't know that was down in there. By the way, a cove, C-O-V-E, is a term for a valley inside a ring of mountains. Okay, Karkor was a cove. A cove. This 15,000 Midianites and these two men are down in this depression in these mountains here on this map, or on this map on the wall. They think they're hiding. They think they have gotten away. Not so. It says then in verse 11, Gideon went up by the way of them that dwelt in tents on the east of Nobah and Jabiah, and smote the host, for the host was secure. Secure means they thought they were protected. They thought down in Karkor, nobody could see them. Nobody could find them. Mistake. Mistake. When Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued after them and took the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and discomforted the host. The word discomfort means to rout. To rout. Rout means he didn't leave any of them alive. There's not a single Midianite soldier, of 15,000 soldiers, there's not one of them alive. And now Zebah and Zalmunna are left alive. Zebah and Zalmunna now are taken by Gideon, and they're headed back to Penuel and Succoth and so forth. It doesn't kill them initially. When he gets back to Succoth, actually verse 4, he catches a man of Succoth, a young man, inquires how many of their leaders. There were 77 leaders, okay, of the town. In verse 13, it says, Gideon and the son of Joash returned from battle. King James says, before the sun was up. Before the sun was up. If you've got an American Standard Version, it doesn't say that. It says, by the ascent of Heres. By the ascent of Heres. Okay. When I got out my Hebrew Bible at home and I read this passage, that's exactly what it says. The going up of the Heres. So evidently in this gorge, in that far right-hand arrow, there was a passageway, there was a road, a trail, as it were, that was a common knowledge trail to go up and down out of that river gorge up into the Transjordanian Plateau. And it would have been called the ascent of Heres. Now, Heres is a Hebrew word for the heat that comes from the sun. Now, Sister Mabel Birchfield's been to Jordan and in that region, and it can get pretty hot in that part of the world, can it not? Particularly in the months of May, June, July, August, September. The heat of the sun, okay? If the sun rises in the east, as it does in Jordan and in Israel, and sets in the west, this river gorge, this far right-hand arrow, doesn't get any shade. It doesn't get any shade. The sun follows the gorge. How hot, just out of curiosity, how hot do you think it is in the bottom of that right arrow? How hot? Not any shade from the sun up to the sun down. The ascent of Heres evidently was in that gorge. I wish, and nobody knows where that is, I wish I could find it. And I wish I could take every one of you to Israel, here it would be Jordan, and we could walk the path of Heres. Would that make the hairs stand up on the back of your neck? You're walking in the same path Gideon and his 300 soldiers walked. Folks, this map on this wall right here, that's not mythology. That is a 2014 Google map. That is the country of Israel down the bottom. That is the country of Jordan tonight. Tonight. And that is exactly where Judges chapter 8 happened. That's where it all happened. Now, I don't know what that does to your faith or for your faith. Let me tell you something. It says a lot to mine. I'm going to quit right here because I'm already almost an hour into the sermon. How far have we gotten in this chapter? A third. But listen very carefully. When God tells a man to do something and then tells him, and here's how you're going to do it, and I'm going to be with you, and if you do it, you will be victorious. Don't ever question God. Just do what He tells you to do. God has never lost a battle. Not physically, not emotionally, not mentally, and especially not spiritually. And Gideon believed that. The men of Succoth didn't. The men of Penuel didn't. And when Gideon comes back victorious, they wished they'd paid attention. If you're here tonight, you're not a Christian, then you're battling the greatest enemy, because that enemy is Satan. If you give in to him, continue down this path, he that is not with me is against me. You remember when Gideon, give me the bread. No, then he that is not with me is against me. And that's how Gideon executed the judgment on these two towns. You didn't side with me, you get treated like the enemy. Just like I'm about to put these two guys to death right here. Stiff consequences, isn't it? Law of Moses was tough. Days of the Judges was even tougher. We're under the gospel of Jesus Christ. Being enemies of God because of sin, God sent His Son into the world to save us from that. That we might, listen to this phrase, be delivered from the wrath to come. 1 Thessalonians 1 verse 10 says, the wrath to come. What did the cities of Succoth and Penuel have to look forward to when Gideon left? What did they have to look forward to? I'll tell you what they had to look forward to. The wrath to come. That's what they had to look forward to. When a person doesn't side with God, this is the consequence. When a person sides with God, it's victory. By the way, I'll take victory, won't you? I want to be a winner. Believing that Christ is the Son of God, repenting of one's sins, confessing the faith one has in Jesus Christ, being baptized into Christ, you rise to walk in what? Romans 6 and verse 4. New life. That's victory. It's victory. As a matter of fact, Romans 4 says, you are raised in the likeness of His resurrection. Raised in the likeness of His resurrection. What does that mean to you and to me? By the way, what's next Sunday? Easter Sunday. Anybody going to be thinking about the resurrection next Sunday? Let me tell you something. I think about the resurrection all the time. I don't need a Sunday to think about the resurrection. What's a resurrection mean to me? That means when I came up out of the watery grave of baptism, I was raised in the likeness of my Lord. And when He was raised from the dead, death has no dominion over me. And when the Lord raises my body, death will have no dominion over me. I'm in a win-win situation. If I live now, I live for Christ. If I die, I go to heaven. I know that for a fact. Philippians 1:21 says that. Now, if I don't obey the gospel, if I obey the gospel and live an unfaithful life, I'm in a lose-lose situation. I lose now, and I lose eternally. I'll take winning, won't you? Obey the gospel. Be faithful to your Lord, who is your champion, who is the one who is the author and the finisher of your faith. Look unto Him. Obeying that gospel, if you need to come back to your first love, be like a Gideon. Show that great faith that I want to be on the Lord's army. I want to be on that side. I'll fight whatever battles it takes, particularly the spiritual ones. And I'll stand shoulder to shoulder with God's people. And we will do, as the old song sings, we are marching to Zion. Beautiful, beautiful Zion. Now, while Brother Jerry leads us in a song, if you're subject, won't you come to stand and sing?